day! And welcome to The Librarianess Inn, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I am still Frank.
And I am Crystal.
And here we are to talk about books, maybe a little culture, and certainly what to read next. How you doing, kid?
Doing all right. Yeah. On National Coffee Day, supposedly.
Well, by the time this airs, it won't be anymore. But I think every day is National Coffee Day.
Yes.
Don't you think? I mean, with the memes out there, there's lots of coffee, which gets us through the day. Here's some.
I already finished mine. Mm-hmm.
How could you not have that crutch? Coffee is a crutch. Sometimes you just need, I just need a cup of coffee in my hand just to know it's there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if I've had too much, I just still have to buy another one just to be like, it's there just in case I need that moment. Like, I won't be able to perform. I won't be able to give all I've got. Oh, the demands. Today is one of those days where I guess coffee is the only thing. Coffee is the only thing. It's been so somewhat, what's the word? Not unbusy, but like, since I'm at another branch, it's been very steady and uneventful, but nice. And today, somehow, a whole bunch of things happened at once. But that's the way it works, right? Mm-hmm,
for sure.
It's not what happens. It's how you deal with it. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, I'm relating to the book I read about equanimity. Mm-hmm. Equanimity. Do you know what that means?
Kind of. I don't know how to
dare Google it.
I'm not. My hands are free. You can see my hands.
Use your brain.
Get them in camera.
You have one.
Like, is it like steadiness or equilibrium-ishness?
Absolutely. You know? See? Like a sort of unencumbered or unbothered steadiness of mind, mm-hmm. which is a good thing to have.
Mm-hmm. I wish I had more of that.
And the lead character of the book I read has it in spades. But the problem, the interesting problem with that is that she's a robot.
Oh, This is not where I thought this was going.
Where did you think it was going?
I don't know why I went to like Ernest Hemingway.
Oh.
Because lot of his main characters, they have that kind of like ice under fire type of quality, very stoic, you know? Mm. And then you said she, and then you said robot, and I was like, no.
Right. No she or no robot for Ernest. Mm-hmm. But that was a great leap. Mm. See, that was a little guessing game that you got to play. But we won't bring up guessing games since the betrayal of last time.
I love how smoothly you wove that in.
See, I can't let it go. Let's talk about not having equanimity.
I forgot. I have a bad memory.
I know. I still look forward to it, too. But we'll do it again, and you will
obey. We did do it, though.
What do you mean?
I did give you a quote, and then you
But it wasn't. You knew I wouldn't get it. We were, let's not retread old horrors. Speaking of horror, we're going to read something scary the next time. Something horror-y. Mm-hmm. Creepy, scary, and Crystal will let everyone know what that is at the end of this mm-hmm. thing we're doing right now. But I guess I started talking about my book, which I always do first, because age before beauty, pearls before swine. I read Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Oh, very interesting. His, already similarities with mine, but I won't say it yet.
Really?
But go ahead.
His first book since winning the Nobel Prize in 2017. And he also wrote really one of my top three favorite books of all time, which is Never Let Me Go, mm-hmm. Which we've talked about on this podcast way back when Gwen was here. And Gwen and I talked about Never Let Me Go. And we both sort of choked up at the end talking about it. It's funny. I was profoundly affected by Never Let Me Go, and but when I was talking about it with her, like at the same time, we both sort of felt the weight of what he was talking about, and it made us tear up a bit. And Kazuo Ishiguro has that effect on me, maybe on lots of people, certainly. There's something about, like you said before, the stoic, reserved, not spineless, selfless characters that inhabit his books that is something so poignant about them when their selflessness, their selflessness is directed at betrays them. You know, what is betrayal? Remains of the Day, the butler gives his all to his lord and master who turns out to be a Nazi or a fascist. And in Clara and the Sun, this Ishiguro's themes are played out as well. So in Clara and the Sun, Clara is the robot or artificial friend, as they're called in the book. It's basically, one of those in the not too distant future. So the world looks very similar to the one we're in, but there are some words like jargon used to refer to things in the culture that we don't know yet, but that we could figure out what they are. Like they call these devices that people constantly look at oblongs, or Ishiguro calls them oblongs, which clearly are like tablets or phones or, And so Clara is an artificial friend created for children, young people, to have a friend, because in this culture, this not too distant American culture, wealthy or, clued in kids don't really go to school anymore because it's not enough for them. They learn on their devices through different tutors. And they also go through a procedure called lifting, which you gather to mean is some genetic intervention in the child themselves, like surgery, basically, to make them smarter. And a lot is made of the well, not, see, that's the thing. Not a lot is made of it. A lot of the world in which we're building, which we're reading, is not given intense world building. He refers to all of these things obliquely, like offhand. It's just up to the reader to sort of fill in those blanks. He doesn't go into detail about a lot. Like he doesn't explain what the oblong is. He doesn't explain really what lifting is. One character mentions like, oh yeah, what's the term? Genetic, remember the word. Just like genetic intervention. Genetically enhanced. Lifted kids are genetically enhanced, but that's all you get. You don't know what that means. You don't know if it's a surgical procedure, but it's some procedure that actually can have some effects on the child's body in terms of getting sick or not. But in the culture, you could see the parallels. Those who have get lifted, genetically enhanced, and then they have a leg up on the fast track to higher education and a successful life. So some parents can't afford it, or I think, or choose not to do it because they don't want to put their kid through it. And indeed, one kid possibly dies from this procedure. So the kids are so on their devices all the time learning because they're not in school. It's all about home tutoring one-on-one, which also sounds familiar considering the pandemic when so many kids are on the computer at home. But this was written before. And so artificial friends are created to give these isolated kids actual friends or companions so they don't feel lonely, so they don't have to feel loneliness. And every once in a while, these interaction parties are created by all these lifted kids to attend so they can work on their social skills, of which they have minimal social skills. So they're literally called interaction parties, where the parents like are in the other room and the kids sort of try to talk to each other and function. So Clara is an artificial friend, and she's in her store in the window, very observant. She's a very observant AF, is what they're called. I know, I thought of that too. Artificial friend AF. So again, how things become what they are is not fully delineated. You're dropped into this world, and it's all through Clara's point of view. It's first person narrative, so you only get what she sees and thinks. And So a lot of what she refers to, like the lifted children or the oblongs, are just mentioned. They're not, of course, gone into detail because it's a part of everyday life. And you sort of figure it out on your own. Whether you're right in quotes or not is up to you, because Ishiguro doesn't further go into it, which I sort of like sometimes, that you're sort of dropped into this world and you can figure it out for yourself and decide how this, what this might mean. Like I said, I was going to say, Clara is a very observant, she's referred to by the manager of the store that she's in, as she's merchandise basically, as observant and very intuitive and watchful, and that she's different from the other AFs. And so you could sort of say, well, I guess each artificial friend is slightly different, even though they're robots. I guess their circuitry is such, none of this is described, is such that they can develop. Certainly can develop, because Clara says the more she observes, the more she listens, the more she learns, which changes her functions. She learns emotions, and it's all geared towards whoever buys her. It's all geared towards making that kid, child, teenager, feel happy, productive, less alone. And it's all geared towards that. She is single-minded in that, and they're created for that. But they obviously have different personalities, the artificial friends, but all geared towards the same goal. So that's how it starts, and that's how it sets up. And she's eventually bought. The more I talk about it, it sounds like slavery too. It sounds like sort of metaphor for that. Or servitude for sure. So she's bought by a little girl, or a little girl. She's like 14, with her mom, and the mom's very anxious and concerned about the purchase. But the 14-year-old Josie wants Clara. There are newer models coming out that year or something, and the mom's like, "Don't you want a newer model?" She's like, "No, I want Clara." So she's bought by this household, Josie and her mother. Mother's divorced. And she joins the household, and the events transpire from there. And it's very interesting read. I mean, it's from the point of view of Clara. So she's a very, like we said, very stoic, reserved, selfless, and formal speaking. So some could find it dry. I mean, it's sort of like what you see beneath what she's saying, or interpret what she's seeing and how she's telling us. I mean, reliable or unreliable, she's what we have. And it's interesting because she talks a lot about the sun. The title is Clara and the Sun, and the robots are solar powered. So the sun to Clara, and it's unclear whether it's this way for all the artificial friends, is a deity to her. It's like God. It's like something she's reverent to and grateful for and believes wholeheartedly in, because it's what gives her life, which is another, you know, comparison to religion in lots of ways. And so she believes in it unreservedly. And again, like I said, Ishiguro doesn't say whether this is a component of all the artificial friends or it's something Clara has developed herself, which is very interesting to think about how robots. I mean, we know enough about sci-fi, even about, you know, technology, that robots or created tech electronic things can develop consciousness, or can respond, what we would see as consciousness, can respond in real time to human beings by taking in that data and then processing it and giving back to us what seems like a reasonable response. So it only, I don't understand it, but it only stands to know that these circuits can develop. So lots of issues are presented in the book. And I realize that I love him because he does. I was sort of, again, as usual, like, how do I talk about this book and present it in a way that says, here's what it's about. And then I realized, you know, it's about the main issues we've been talking about since time immemorial. Like, what is life? What is happiness? What is love? And what is love is a great question too, because when I thought about that, I was like, oh no, not that question again. I bring that up all the time, and I translate lots of books into that question, like, I want every book I read to be about what is love. And then I realized it suddenly hit me, like, we ask that question, what is love, probably more than we actually say what love is.
Mm-hmm.
And then it made me realize, well, we don't know. Or it constantly changes. Like, mm-hmm. you know, a parent could say, my child is love. Or, you know, a newlywed couple could say, my partner is love. I mean, I don't know. It's a feeling that comes, and when it's there, we know it. And then how to describe it. And then does it sustain?
Mm-hmm.
Can it sustain? Because there's something very, I mean, at least to me, very poignant and attractive about a Clara who is, again, selfless and, but not, again, spineless. She has opinions and she does develop them and she does say them. And it's interesting when she's at one of those interaction parties I mentioned before where the kids get together because they're so isolated to try to interact with each other and learn social skills. And of course it devolves into bullying mm-hmm. and sort of, you know, very familiar gatherings as we know them. Especially with tweens and or young teens, and the bullying centers on Clara, and she will not respond. She does not respond to any of their taunts or questions. And you think, well, maybe she only responds to her owners,
mm-hmm.
Josie and the mom. But then also, it seems to say also she doesn't respond to unkindness.
Mm.
She only mm-hmm. responds to a kindness and gives it in kind. She gives it back. And I wrote a note about that, about kindness. I think, that Clara has dignity. There's a dignity about her, which is so attractive. That's stoicism over complaining. She doesn't complain. It's just forward motion in terms of her goals, which are always about Josie, about pleasing and making sure this girl is okay, because that's her job. That's what she was wired, so-called, mm-hmm. to do. And in a way, we sort of feel sorry for her way more than she feels sorry for herself, because she doesn't have that in her to sort of pity herself at all, whereas the mother of Josie, whose other daughter is the one that died possibly because of the lifting, the genetic reorganization, is a basket case of nerves and concerns and mm-hmm. sometimes even selfish. Like, there's a plot line that goes where Josie's sick and she's doing everything she can to make sure that if she does die, she's basically going to have an artificial Josie recreated by this new process. And then she questions that, and much is made of, what is human in us be transferred to something artificial? And there's a character who says, yeah, absolutely. We scientists have looked into it, and it's totally, there's nothing there in humans that can't be transferred. And then of course, Ishiguro indicates that's possibly not the case. And Clara herself, by the end of the book, says unequivocally that whatever, cause she's the one that, spoiler alert, or one of them. The mom really all agreed to buy her because she was going to use Josie's, you know, Clara's circuitry to recreate a Josie. By there's more detail in the book about that, but like she was going to basically take her AF-ness and her robotness and convert it into a new Josie if Josie died. And the scientist who was going to do it, scientist/artist in a way, was like, yeah, it's totally possible. There's nothing in us that can't be transferred. And then Ishiguro has Clara at the end say, she's glad it didn't happen because it doesn't happen. Josie survives because there is something more in the people that love us that an artificial friend doesn't have. That only the person has. And it's more about the person people love. Like, she didn't think that the mother and the father and the other people in Josie's life would love her as Josie because she was lacking something that was essentially Josie.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge question. That's a huge existential discussion about what do we have soul? Like, you know, so I just rambled on and on, but like, at the beginning, I thought it was going to be like Ian McEwan's like machines, like, people like us about,
mm-hmm.
I talked about this on the podcast too, about robots that are part of our everyday life. And I was going to ask you, like, if there was such a thing as like an artificial friend, would you want one?
Like a Furby.
I don't know what a Furby is. I think I do. Do I?
But like a really kind of advanced artificial life friend.
Yeah.
No.
You sound unsure.
I think it gets complicated, right? Because it's sort of like as a human being with a robot friend or something, which sounds so silly. It's like you it I think it's hard for humans to not what's the word? Like personify or attribute so much humanness to like animals, to different things. I mean,
Yeah.
you put some googly eyes on the stapler and all of a sudden it has emotions kind of thing.
You're right. I mean, you're right. That's a great point.
And to have it maybe not be able to return that same kind of investments, I think would be difficult. And if it was able to, then I would also be scared. So I feel like there's no good choices there.
And it brings up all these existential questions too. Like, Clara is so admirable in so many ways, and other people and people in the books, the humans in the books say it, and the reader feels it too. That whose consciousness becomes more val consciousness in quotes, whose consciousness is more valuable, a human being's or Clara's? I mean, clearly they admire her, and like you just said, there's the personification that happens. Clara is clearly, again, not gotten into, but clearly enough of an art looks like enough of like a robot that everyone can tell an artificial friend in the street, in the book. But yet she has hair and face, and so there is the personification that attracts people. But yeah, I mean, we haven't even figured out how to get along with each other, human beings. Like, why introduce this, like this technological advance just because you can? There's actually a character in the book who says who's developing a drone, and he's someone questions him about like, well, it might be used for like nefarious purposes, like spying on people and stuff like that. And he says, he's a sweet character actually, but he says, well, but he did what he did was divide the division of labor. He's like, well, I'm the inventor. I'll leave the rest of it up to the legislators. And suddenly I realized, of course, like people who invent or create, like possibly do it with the thrill and excitement and satisfaction of coming to fruition, this project or creation, like a computer or a device, or how our devices have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. And of course, we talk all about our devices. And then at the same time, which is such a strange thing in the culture, talk about how terrible they are, or how much we're on them too much, or how much they, we lost in quotes through the devices. I mean, I remember in the 70s, they talked about TV that way. Everybody watched TV, but then there was all these things about how terrible it is. So at the same time, like then you think, well, why invent these things if it's like not really improving the quality of our life, or maybe in some ways, but not ultimately, existentially, because inventors got to invent and then legislators got to legislate.
Yeah,
Suddenly
and
that divide seems so made so much sense.
I also think like with it seems like with inventors, maybe you invent something with the goal of this being used a certain way, but it doesn't prevent other people from using it in like more nefarious ways, possibly.
Right. There's always a downside.
I think about like the
Yeah.
benefits of drone technology, the downsides of drone technology, and like the military and things like that. So be very tricky. I also think too with that whole scenario that you suggested about like a best robot friend or something. I think, when there's consciousness, there's also choice. So like maybe how would people feel if you did have like that friend and they essentially did not like want to be there? Would you like keep them? This it's
Yeah.
I think that kind of goes up against what you were saying earlier about Clara and maybe being kind of like caught in this system. Not having choice.
I mean, I can certainly imagine the older I get, like the companion thing about a companion that's geared towards really just making me feel good and not lonely, is very attractive, and sort of the willingness to subsume my my knowledge that they're not really real, in quotes. And then, but then the question is like, well, what is real? I mean, if they're talking to me, responding to me, having a conversation with me, seeming to love me, care about me, what's not real about that? I mean, but it just adds too much complication. I'd rather learn how to be alone than deal with that issue. I really, as a matter of principle, personally. But therefore, I can imagine it being released into the world. You know, you can imagine a time where they're going to have these robots that are just like in this book, and you know, people will be like, "I love mine," or like, "It's solved my loneliness," or whatever. And other people will be like, "It's the end of civilization." It's like, oh my God, I'm exhausted with that line of thinking. But speaking of loneliness, like, which is another big issue in the book, is that Clara doesn't have that. It's very poignant at one point. And it's interesting, like you say personification, like you put googly eyes on a stapler, and it becomes personified.
Maybe
Is
it's
that
anthropomorphizing? Is that the word?
anthropomorphize? Yes.
Anthropomorphizing, yeah.
That as Josie grows up, she has less need for Clara, and has a lot, and Josie has a lot of friends over, so Clara's sort of not in the room with Josie anymore. Like she doesn't sleep. She'll just like stand in the corner and like, you know, log out. But then as Josie grows up, Clara's like, well, I could see that I was not useful in the room, or there wasn't room for me in the room. So she found like a small, like, you know, utility closet and just stood there at night. And of course, we're like, oh God, oh God. Like, we would never do in, you know, in our best selves, do that to a person. Like, you know, oh, well, there's no room. So just, you know, sleep in the closet, in this small closet with a mop and a pail. But that's personifying her. She doesn't, that's what I meant about we almost grieve more for her or feel sorry for her than she does herself. She doesn't feel sorry for herself. And it doesn't feel self-pitying. She's just like, it's what it is. And it's not even a thing. It's not even an issue. It's just a mention of like, this is what I did and this is what I had to do. Because her goal was about Josie. So she's not gonna, it's not a thing at all. But yet we, as humans, possibly make it that way. And, you know, the ending, the last six pages are classic, quintessential, why I love him to death, Ishiguro. It's just great. Like, he pushes my buttons like almost nobody else. I mean, Ishiguro is one of the writers I would read anything he wrote. Anything that he wrote, I would want to know what's on this guy's mind. I love him. I mean, there's a sort of love for him in a way. His words, I don't know anything about him, and I don't want to know anything about him in a way. I mean, I know he won the Nobel and the award winning, but I just love reading his books to hear what he has to say. And it's always revolves around those characters that have this great inner dignity, I guess maybe I strive for, because Lord knows dignity is not the first word that comes to mind when you think of me. So
I mean, it is interesting to hear about his other works because the only one that I've read is Remains of the Day, which is like not a sci-fi book. Definitely does not have robots unless I'm missing something in that one. But it does seem like very similar themes carry through. Maybe some of that like memory loneliness, maybe the idea of like projecting yourself onto the main character and like really feeling their experiences of isolation. I don't know, this seems really interesting. I kind of want to read it, but I feel like I'm going to cry, so I
I
don't know.
know. I mean, it hits you in a cumulative, because like there were times reading it when I was like, oh boy, wow. It's just so formal, and like Clara's view is very much a telling view. Like Ishiguro can't show so much because it's Clara's point of view, so she tells us a lot of what she sees. I mean, there's some incredibly beautiful passages, especially related to the sun and her belief in its restorative power, related to Josie. She embarks on a mission with that, but and she has this thing where you, when she sees that, when she's disturbed or something disturbing or maybe something confusing to her is happening, she partitions what she sees like in boxes, and you almost get the indication of like her circuitry is pixelated and stuff. But it also metaphorically shows like how we sometimes get disoriented when we are confused, upset ourselves. And what she sees is like, you know, let's say you were upsetting me right now, which you can conceivably could do, Crystal. I would, and I were Clara, I would partition you into boxes and I would be into one. And not only would your face have different expressions, like because what's made much of in this book, which I love, is that what's happening in front of you is not always what you think it is, or multiple things are happening. Like you could be very gleeful that you're upsetting me, Crystal.
No.
You could also feel remorseful that you are. Mm-hmm. So Clara, being a robot, sees the remorse and the glee in different boxes. And so she tries to, I never really understood this till I'm talking about it now. She sees them in separate boxes and then they eventually coalesce when she decides or figures out what's happening. And oftentimes it's many things are happening at once and she accepts that. That might be a key to Clara's dignity in that she can accept many things happen at once. What did I start this whole conversation off with? Like a lot of stuff's happening today and it's sort of weighing on me. It doesn't weigh on her. She partitions, she coalesces and moves on. And it's obviously, you know, the existential question of why we can't do that. And also face do it with quicker equanimity where we can partition and organize quickly, or not quickly, but fruitfully and without stress, without undue stress on ourselves, because, but yet we do.
I think that's
the question.
I think that's also a very human emotion of like wanting to be a robot in some ways, to be able to not deal with some of the stresses and different pains of being human. But then, of course, like the great sacrifice of being a robot is that you don't feel like the great joys and all of those things too. So,
I mean, she did feel joy though. She felt joy when it was related to her task. Josie, like when she felt she succeeded, which she does feel by the end of the book, she has succeeded, not necessarily in the way you'd think. And she feels anxious too, because like there's a couple in the book that seem to be perfect for each other, or I don't know, just like a couple in the book. And when it doesn't work out, Clara says it made her anxious. That it didn't work out, but yet she moved on from it and realized all is good. I hate that term, moved on from it. Like all the psychological jargon we use, like, what does that mean, moved on? She processed it. Well, let's use computer terms. She processed it and realized or processed it and the data revealed that all was good. I don't know. But there's a couple of moments in the book that allude to other issues. Like I mentioned slavery before, just servitude and what that means, like how serving someone changes you and how being served changes you. And one point a character is interacting with Clara and says, oh, you're an artificial friend. Like I've never met one. I'm not sure how I should handle you. Are you like a guest here or should I just treat you like a vacuum cleaner? It's like, and Clara's just like, blink, blink, you know, doesn't matter to me. But like, she's like, should I treat you like a vacuum cleaner? Because you're, you know, a machine. So, yeah, there's a lot in here. And if you're a fan of Ishiguro, you should definitely read it. And I also find the issues he brings up very important and almost sometimes unanswerable, just sort of seem to keep taking it in. And it can, depending, you know, like the right book, right time. Sometimes a book can change things for you, like bring you to the next level of understanding of yourself. So that's really all it is. I mean, this is another thing I felt like I always talk about language giving us meaning, because we have, you know, we're all human. We all have experiences. And the only other thing is language to describe them. And then by describing them, says who we are, decides things for us. I mean, putting it into language decides. What are you laughing at?
No, it's good.
Oh, decides things for us. But then I thought, I was reading a book like this, and I was like, it's not giving me language this might be the core of it, and this is where I'll leave it. This book did not give me language to understand myself better. What it did was forced me to think about things about existential questions and life that eventually could lead me to my own language to understand myself better. But Ishiguro doesn't give it to you. And maybe that's something that's very admirable. He asks you, by his stories, you're required to think about them unless you have a heart of stone. Even an artificial friend would think about them. Clara certainly would. Oh, I love Clara all of a sudden. Anyway, that's Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro.
I was just thinking, like, I really regret, like, encountering his work in high school and just, like, how, you know, in high school you do a lot of forced reading. Not forced reading. No, it was forced reading.
Required reading?
That's the word. Time? Required. That's a better.
Great.
And I think, you know, the more I think about this book and the way you talk about his work, I feel like it's underappreciated for me because I don't know if Remains of the Day was like the right book for me when I was a teenager, but I think thinking back on it now, I probably could relate to it a lot more. But yeah, I don't know.
Interesting that you read that in high school. That is an interesting book.
I think I did. Or college. I'm not sure. It all blurs together, really.
Yeah. So how did your book relate? You were like, oh, that's sort of related.
Yes. The more you talked about your book, I found like more similarities to it. So the book I'm going to talk about is Half World by Hiromi Goto. And there's illustrations by Jillian Tamaki. Hiromi Goto is also somebody who is from the Japanese diaspora. So she's Japanese Canadian. She also wrote Shadow Life, which I had talked about prior at like another thing, not for the podcast, which is this comic book that came out this year, written by Hiromi Goto, and I think the art was by, I want to say, Ann Shu. And it's about that 76-year-old woman who like escapes from a senior home. Her adult daughters are trying to chase her, and she's like made her own life, and like death is stalking her, and she has to fight death. And it's this like wonderful, amazing, smart, funny, like lively comic book that I think is like great for all ages. So because I read that one and enjoyed it so much, I kind of went back and looked at Goto's backlist. And Half World is a young adult title that was written a decade ago. And the basic premise of it is that there are these three worlds. We have the realm of the flesh, the realm of the spirit, and then the half worlds. And I think if you think about like Christian religion, it would be like, you know, our mortal realm, maybe purgatory being the half world, and then heaven being the spirit realm. And it's described as like, you know, when people die, they go into the half world, they kind of work through many of their issues, their tribulations. And then when they're ready, they pass into the realm of the spirits where they can like live whatever living is in a very like happy, joyful way. But something happens, those three worlds are fractured. And because it's fractured, the spirit, not spirits, or I guess they're half living people in the half world sort of turn into these monstrous creatures. And then the story then goes into a very like short scene where these two characters, Fumiko and Shinobu, who are from the half world, are pregnant. Fumiko's pregnant and they are trying to leave, and they've never had like a baby in the half world. And so they are trying to leave. They get to this gate with a gatekeeper, and in order to pass into the realm of the flesh, they have to kind of make a sacrifice, which is like a pinky or something. And then you have this character called Mr. Glueskin, which sounds very, very silly, but is actually it's very gross. I have a passage I'll read kind of describing him. And he comes and he does not let them leave, but eventually makes a deal where the pregnant mother can go into the living worlds if she returns in 14 years with the child. And if she doesn't.
This pregnant woman died and was in the half world.
Should
have technically have gone on to the spirit world. So she was a pregnant woman who actually died and she's in the half.
No. My understanding of it is she died is in this kind of like purgatory half worlds. The three worlds were split, so she was trapped there. And then the pregnancy happened, which is like very, very unusual. So,
You
and
know
there's
why?
like these.
How? Was there a,
No.
she just was chilling with some guy in the half world and got
Well,
pregnant?
apparently there's like some prophecy, I think, where like if a child is born, it could mend the worlds together. And I think that's why Mr. Gluskin wants to prevent them from like leaving.
But
But
how did
eventually,
she get pregnant?
I mean, biology, I don't know.
Well, it doesn't go into a relationship then.
No, this is like literally the introduction, right?
All right, so you're it's part of the premise.
This is just the opening of it
No,
where,
I'm sorry.
and eventually,
I wanted to orient myself. I was hoping for
they.
romance. I was hoping for some romance. All right.
It's a young adult book, not too heavy on
Is it a
that,
graphic
but
novel?
no, it's a prose novel,
It's
and
illustrated.
there are, I would say, like five
Oh,
drawings
okay.
in it. It's
All
not like super illustrated or anything like
right.
that.
Okay.
And so, I mean, eventually, like her partner like makes a sacrifice of his pinky, and she's able to go into the world. And then the novel actually opens with the child, who at this point is 14, coming home from school, I believe. And then her mom is missing, right? And then she kind of follows a series of clues, and then realizes that she has to go into the half world to like retrieve her mom to try to save her. And she has like the help of this character named like Mrs. Wei, who gives her this like jade rat that like comes to life because the jade rat has a spirit of like somebody else in it. And so there's a lot of like fantastical elements. This book is kind of compared to like Coraline, which I think by Neil Gaiman, which I think is like, there's a lot of similarities in how they're both able to kind of draw out this fantastical world and give it a lot of life. One of the things that I found to be interesting that was in comparison with your title is this idea of like kindness being something that is a saving grace. And I guess maybe slight spoiler, the way that she is able to kind of fight evil is by rejecting evil, by like not engaging the same kind of monstrous like pathways that the denizens of Half World are engaging in. So I'm gonna just read a passage that kind of describes Mr. Glueskin, which is again a hilarious name, but just like is so gross. The passage reads, Mr. Glueskin caught sight of the emotions on Melanie's face. Rage twisted his loose features. Contorting, seething, he dropped his jaw to the ground, his mouth flapping wider than his body like a gulper eel. Melanie stared down his maw. The moist, acrid stink of vinegar burned her eyes, choking, vile, and noxious. The skin inside his mouth, down his throat, gleamed white like larvae, threads of glue stringing downward like melting mozzarella. Mr. Glueskin unrolled his widened, flattened tongue like it was a red carpet. When it was completely distended, he wrapped the sticky tip lovingly and gently around Melanie's torso, pinning her arms to her sides. He squeezed ever so softly, like the most kindly embrace, then began to gently pull her into his maw.
Ooh.
It's very like descriptive. You have like the smells, you have like the visuals, you have like just it's very like.
Sticky tip.
Yes, and there's
But
a
also
lot
like
of.
the rolling out the red carpet.
I
That's
know. Such
pretty
a
cool, right?
interesting like villain character, and what happens to him at the end is also very interesting. Like I did not expect it, and I feel like a lot of times when I do read a lot of YA fantasy, you kind of maybe know what's coming because there's a lot of certain tropes and stuff. And I feel like this one
Oh.
was a little like surprising for me.
Well, wait. So you're not telling, but let me just pretend for a second. Like
Okay,
Mr.
got
Glueskin
it. Yes.
might turn into something good, let's say. Like that might be surprising.
It
That might
could
be
be.
possible surprising. And you reminded me of and you said tropes too, like the tropes that we that a lot of book that a lot of our storytelling follows. And Clara and the Sun reminded me of this too, and what you just said reminded me of it, the story of Beauty and the Beast. And that, which I love, especially the Jean Cocteau film version. But Beast is not this unfeeling, insensate character who is evil. and horrible and it just looks frightful, but is something much, much more. And something, I think what I mean most by that is that his trajectory makes us cry, just like Clara's might, and that there's the quality of dignity or stoicism or bearing under pressure and that we admire.
Mm-hmm.
And no self-pity. I think that lack of self-pity. But I'm giving a lot to Mr. Gluck, and I guess I shouldn't give him too much.
No, you shouldn't. You should not, Frank. Mr. Gluck is quite terrible.
He doesn't turn into a Prince Charming and then co-parents the baby that's born.
So, well, I mean, I do, in some respects, yes, right? And some of it is like the way they kind of ultimately describe some of the characters who are stuck in this half world is that their lives keep regenerating in some way, but they're not able to like work through their trauma. So they're just constantly reliving their trauma, which causes them to become these sorts of monsters, right? And I think that's very interesting because there are certain elements of the story. First of all, it reminds me a little bit of like 12 Dancing Princesses, that fairy tale. It certainly reminds me of the Orpheus myth from like, was it Greek or Roman mythology? Do you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Where he goes into Hades to try to bring back his wife and then, you know, it's not supposed to look back but does and then like loses
Eurydice.
Her. Oh, maybe that one.
Eurydice
yeah.
is the wife.
Oh, Joe the wife, Pascoe yes.
also did a movie of Orpheus. He did Beauty and the Beast.
I don't know that reference.
From the 40s, but anyone should pick those, either one of those movies up. They're amazing and beautiful.
So,
and in French.
So yeah. with this, I do feel like there are these overtones of, so when she does go back, she does eventually find her mom, and her mom doesn't seem to recognize her and seems like she's very like lost in this world, and she also maybe like encounters her father as well, and they are just maybe drinking a lot, engaging in the excesses of the world but with no recognition of her. And personally for me, I wondered if this was kind of a metaphor for like a teen or a young person who perhaps like loses their parent to alcoholism or drug use and trying to go back in and like retrieve them from that and trying to remind them of like, this is the real world, this is our connection, and having a lot of difficulty doing that. And it resolves in a really interesting way, I think. I think it's done well. I think the main character does have this kind of inner pillar of strength that she really has to rely on. And I, you know, I feel like this was very affecting to me. Like, I didn't care about Mr. Gluckin at all in his journey, but the journey of Melanie and her mom, Fumiko, was very touching, and the sacrifices that they kind of both make for each other. I also appreciate, like, how there's a scene early on where she has to cross this bridge. Melanie has to cross this bridge, and with the help of Jade Rat, at a certain point, it seems like, and the bridge is made up of these, like, flying crows. So as they're flying, she has to jump across their backs to get to the other side, right? But it seems almost like it's not going to happen. And then her animal pal Jade Rats just goes on ahead, right? And she feels a certain kind of way about it because she was like, well, the rat was going to abandon me. And then they have a conversation afterwards, and the Jade Rat was like, well, she does make it across, but if you were going to be lost, we could have both been lost. So I made a decision that like I had to go forward to complete this mission or whatever. And at the end of the book, she's put in a similar situation, right? And she has to make a choice with her parents or herself and maybe something that she's carrying that's very valuable that can help, you know, combine the three realms together. And she, I think, is put in a position where she understands why those choices were made. So I think that shows a lot of character growth. But that was like really well done. And the art, of course, there's the, I think, five or so illustrations by Jillian Tamaki, who is like very, I think, well known in the comics, graphic novel realm, especially for teens, are really beautiful. They're kind of like ink drawings. Yeah, really enjoyed this one. Out of 5 stars.
Yeah, great. I want to go back to Mr. Gluckin. Because now it concerns me that you brought him up and you made a deal with him, and then you then said, I don't care about what happens to him, I care, and then you went on to the other people in the book. It makes me feel like just because he's not so pretty that he's being disparaged. And he's
Well,
being, and also it occurred to me, like, as a teen, it's almost when you described him, it's like how some teens, I certainly did, feel like monsters, especially with like skin issues when you're a teenager. My God, I thought so much about my skin, which was always erupting. But then I thought also, if I read this book, I would be thrilled, and I'm wondering if this is good or not, thrilled to sort of say, well, that's not me. He's so horrible that he's worse than I am. I
I
wouldn't
think
identify, but also I guess he's just not good. You're giving me a, like,
Frank,
Frank, you're making too much of me.
you are the fact that you're relating to Mr. Gluskin, I should also tell you that he was swallowing young children. Like, do you still want to relate to
Nope.
Mr.
Nope. That's true. He opens his maw and rolls out the red carpet.
Well, in his first
Fine.
scene when he is chasing after the couple, you know he's coming because his tongue is going splat, splat, splat against the
Oh,
ground. And
that's
actually, you won't get this reference, or maybe you will, but there's a Pokemon that
Barely on
reminds
that.
me.
A
There's a
Pokemon.
Pokemon that made me like immediately think of Mr. Gluskin, and that's Lickitung, if anybody's familiar with that Pokemon.
Lickitung.
With it's like this is a Pokemon that has like this very long tongue that's kind of odd, I will say. And Mr. Gluskin, like he there's a scene where she is speaking with like some person, and all of a sudden there's like this dripping thing happening, and it's Mr. Gluskin dripping down from the ceiling using his tongue to grab things. It's very
I don't know. Somehow he's my takeaway
grotesque.
from this. Not the
You're like,
script.
I love Mr. Gluskin.
Don't know. When you were talking about the dripping, it reminded me of Alien.
Spitting glue skin on people's faces so they're suffocating. You like this?
Oh, I thought he had gluey skin.
He does have gluey
And
skin.
he also spits. Ugh, I don't like that. That sounds horrible.
He's
Sounds
very
like
phlegmy too. They talk about his phlegm a
that.
lot. He's not the hero, Frank. He's not the he, and he's not like an anti-hero either. He's a straight villain.
But you did say, and you don't have to reveal it, you did say that what happens to him is surprising. So I guess I was sort of saying maybe he turns it like he's an enchanted, horrible person, but there's a good person underneath. But obviously not.
It's interesting. If people read this, I feel like your last statement was very interesting. But I will say, like, what I meant was, I feel like in a lot of old, not old, sorry, other YA fantasy books, it's sort of you have to like kill the villain in some way, and she kind of doesn't, right? And she purposely prevents other people from doing
Oh.
so, and I think that's the part of like the kindness and like fighting evil by not walking down those same paths of evil and not doing unto him what he was doing unto others. Yeah. But you're very close. I feel like if you
Right.
were to read this book, you'd be like,
So what's title and author, please, again?
It's Half World by Hiromi Goto with illustrations by Jillian Tamaki.
We'll have it on the blog post. Well, thanks.
Oh,
Wow.
wait, wait.
Oh. She's cute. All right, let me
Okay,
listen.
here it is. So it is an object, and there's going to be a lot of different sounds because. Can you hear it? Okay, here's a telling noise, I think.
Oh. All right. First, it sounds like every other sound, like you're just nails on whatever it is, and then it sounded like something snapping back and forth, like there was a snap component to it, and then it sounded like a spritz bottle or a spray, like a perfume spritzer. That. Is that the air?
It's close enough. It's a hand sanitizing spray. I was trying to not poison myself, but yep,
Yeah,
that's what it
that's what it
was.
sounded like. Why would you tapping on it indicate what it is? Just to give you
Because then
the
you,
quality of the material, possibly? The
yes,
plastic? Okay.
I feel like that's very
Because
helpful
I can't.
because a
What
lot
is
of
this
perfume
plastic?
bottles are glass, right? So you would hear maybe a glass noise. This is plastic. So these are all very helpful
All right.
clues. And I feel like you
See?
got it because you heard all the components, including the
Plus.
lids.
Now I'm
So you're
retracting my.
welcome. You're welcome.
All right. Because you're right. I'm retracting my overzealousness because there was a series of noises one has to hear before one guesses it.
Yes,
One did,
yes,
which is me.
yes.
Spritzer. I'll take a spritzer. I'm ready for a spritzer. Can I have a tequila spritzer, please? All right, baby. So tell the people what we're going to
Oh,
read
okay.
together for the book club, which is going to be a spooky, spooky book, possibly.
But not too
But
spooky.
not, but also
Not too
not comic,
spooky,
as I'm
hopefully.
indicating it is. But it sounds intriguing as you talked to me before we got on today. So
Sure, so
remind me and tell everybody.
the book that we decide on for our next podcast is The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones, which came out last year, so I'm very
Okay.
excited.
The only good Indians.
The Only Good
Okay.
Indians.
Don't we won't say a word about it. But suffice to say there's some degree of horror slash spookiness, but it's not
I would
per
imagine.
se an outright it, there's other things going on. I do like my horror intellectual. Certain,
Okay.
I think the best kind is, like I've talked about. I mean, I can't resist sometimes a good old fashioned, like I'm lost in the woods and there's something creepy coming after me. But idea horror makes total sense to me. Well, thanks, Crystal. This was a better pleasure than before. She laughs. She laughs at my existential angst. You're my artificial friend,
Your
Crystal.
AI friend.
AF.
Am I trapped here? Do I have a
You're
choice
Crystal
to leave?
AF. She's Crystal AF. That's what they call
Awesome
them, actually. They're
forever.
Clara
That's what
AF, Rex, awesome and for awesome forever.
There's a comic book called Black AF, and I remember asking the author about it. And he was like, you could say it black at, with the curse word or awesome forever. And I was like, oh, yes, I'll use this with the teens. We'll say black awesome forever.
I mean, I wonder when Ishiguro was writing this, like if AF was in his consciousness about, I mean, this is the tiniest part, or didn't care or wasn't even on his radar. I sort of like to think Ishiguro doesn't even, I wonder if he even has social media. I don't even care because I don't want to know. Like I said before, I don't really want to know anything about him. I just want his books to tell me about him and not
Frank,
sully it up with actual human existence. Sorry. What?
I'm getting a bit overpowered by the smell of hand sanitizer
Okay,
right now.
we should
I'm
go.
so
All right, Crystal's going to seek assistance, and thanks everybody for listening. And
Thanks for listening to The Librarian Is In, a podcast by the New York Public Library. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcast or Google Play, or send us an email at podcasts@nypl.org. For more information about the New York Public Library, please visit nypl.org. We are produced by Christine Farrell. Your hosts are Frank Hilarious and Crystal Chen.